Good afternoon. I'm Robert Wade. I'm a professor of political economy here at LSE. Pascal Lamy sends his apologies at the last minute. He had to go to Brazil. In his place, he has asked his deputy director general, one of four, Valentin Rugwabiza, to speak in his place. I want to just spend a minute introducing her. She was, before becoming Deputy Director General of the WTO in 2005, she was Rwandan ambassador to the UN and to Switzerland. Before that, she was an advisor to the President of Rwanda. Before that, she was CEO of her own company in Rwanda, and before that, she worked as a senior manager in a Swiss multinational. So she has a very unusual combination of skills and experience which she brings to this job, spanning the public sector and the private sector. Today, she's going to talk for roughly half an hour on the theme of the development aspect of the Doha development round. But in the question and answers, she is happy to take questions about the current state of the Doha round, what is hoped to be accomplished by the end of this year, for example. So, over to you. The development aspect of the WTO.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much and good afternoon. I'm quite sure some of you are sincerely very disappointed to not have Pascal Lamy here today. I will just try my best to at least convey part of his message. The other part will come mainly from my own perspective of development and from my own experience of the Doha development agenda, what can be expected and what can be achieved by the end of this year. Should I do it here or?
As you like, wherever you feel comfortable, either sitting or standing, it doesn't matter.
So, ladies and gentlemen, when I first saw this, the title of this conference, is the DDA a development round? This brings me back in the way we name a child in my traditional society. When a child is born in some of our traditional societies, the family only gives it a name 7 days after its birth. On the seventh day, the parents, in fact, organize a big party, and the relatives collectively decide on the name of the child. Then the eldest man of the family holds the baby in his lap, turns his face to the south, and whispers three times the name of the baby. That's a name has been given to a child. And giving a name to a round of trade negotiations is also a complex business. As in our traditional societies, there is a collective decision, a celebration, a little bit of movement as well, and whispering also among WTO members. What trade negotiators, in my view, have not yet learned from the wise people of our villages is to wait a while until they give a name. The current round of trade negotiations, the Doha Development Agenda, or the DDA, as we used to name it in our jargon, bears the name of the city of Doha, Qatar, where the ministerial conference was held in 2001. It also has the word development in it, meaning that this round should be focused on, or at least aimed at, development. This decision by the WTO members to designate the Doha round a development round was a recognition that they remain in today's multilateral trading system, imbalances in the rules and disciplines, and that those imbalances penalize developing countries, that must be corrected. The intention, therefore, was and is to try to improve the multilateral disciplines. Why? We need to provide all members of the WTO a level playing field with better conditions to enable particularly developing countries to reap the benefits of opening trade. Several imbalances in the multilateral trade system were not addressed in all the previous rounds, including the very last one, the Uruguay round. When the current round was launched in 2001, developing countries made it a condition that these imbalances should be addressed with the priority of reforming or at least improving the multilateral trading system. What are these imbalances? I will try to give you one example. If one looks closely at the structure of the industrial tariffs, especially in developed countries, they remain there oddities like tariff peaks and tariff escalation. This means that very often the highest import tariffs in developed countries are applied on products in which, as if by coincidence, developing countries have a comparative advantage. I'll try to give an illustration of this tariff escalation issue. The United States collects more tariffs on goods imported from Cambodia, an LDC, than it does on goods imported from France, a developed country. In January 1996, the US imported $3 billion worth of French goods and collected roughly $30 million in import tariffs. The very same month, the US imported only $200 million worth of goods from Cambodia. That is less than 10% of the US imports from France. But the amount of import duties paid was the same, $30 million. How can we justify that a country exporting only one-tenth of what another country exports pays the same amount in duties? The crunch of the problem is the type of goods that each country exports. In the United States, most tariffs on technology and heavy industry goods have been eliminated, as in many other developed countries. In contrast, tariffs on textiles, clothing, footwear are still higher. Even if today employment, production, and trade patterns have changed dramatically. Thus, if a country exports technology, it pays very low duties. This is exactly what developed countries export with each other. But if a country exports low value added products like textiles,
textiles, sorry, clothing, footwear, those are usually produced by poor countries, then it pays high duties. The same is true with the EU, with Japan. Let's look at another example. Imports of cocoa are subject to very low import tariffs to enter the EU or Japan, but processed cocoa pays high import tariffs. And these imbalances basically stem from the past. They are not new, they are not recent, but sometimes also current political and economical factors. Much as there are many new players, new products and new patterns of export and import in today's world market, trade relations are still stained by history, by a heritage of production choices and trading flows formed during colonial times. These imbalances have to be corrected. And the only way developing countries have to try to correct them is through multilateral trade negotiations. They do not have other economic power, other ways to pressurize. Another imbalance in the current disciplines is agriculture. This sector has really never been touched in previous rounds. It is only 10 years ago, in 1995, that we started negotiating agriculture. In other words, the agriculture sector has not been able to benefit from the 50-year process of trade liberalization that we have witnessed in industrial goods. There is clearly a backlog in this area. In order to rebalance this round will have to deliver improved market access, reduce tariffs, and remove quantitative restrictions on products where developing countries have a comparative advantage. Sorry. And here we're talking about the two problems just identified: increased access into the markets of both industrial and agricultural products produced by developing countries. In addition to this improved market access for industrial goods and agricultural products, there should be a rebalancing of the rules and discipline that govern international trade. Those are the rules on trade distorting agricultural subsidies on products such as cotton. Those are the rules that provide, that should provide developing countries with special and differential treatment. And I can keep going on and on with a long list of imbalances which should be corrected. But maybe let's look at what is already on the table today. In agriculture, members have agreed on a date for the elimination of most trade-distorting agricultural subsidies. Those are the export subsidies. This was a key negotiating demand by developing countries, and they will be eliminated in 2013, with a substantial part of them gone by 2010. This is what was agreed in Hong Kong last December. Members have also agreed to achieve effective cuts in trade-distorting domestic subsidies. Another demand of developing countries. Furthermore, on the defensive side, a group of developing countries have made two key demands. One, that they have the flexibility to self-designate a number of special products on criteria of food security, livelihood, and rural development. And two, that they have to be able to use a special safeguard mechanism. Those demands as well have already been addressed. In the important sector of cotton, rich countries agreed to eliminate all export subsidies by the end of this year. They also agreed to make deeper and faster reductions in trade-distorting domestic subsidies for cotton than what will be done with the rest of agricultural products. Finally, developed countries and developing countries able to do so will provide duty and quota-free access to LDC's exports. And that includes cotton as well. As you can see, there are signs that this round achievements are already more than zero, though they are still far from enough. Ensuring that the results of the DDA in terms of market access, in terms of rules, in terms of disciplines, will be beneficial to developing countries is really crucial to the success of this round. But are market access and disciplines enough to promote development? Are these conditions sufficient to increase the level of development of the poor countries in the world? I used to be the coordinator of the African group, and most of those poor countries belong to the African group. The answer to these questions, experience shows, is no. Trade openness and improved disciplines play a vital role in growth and development, but they are not a panacea for all the challenges of development. Trade opening and improved disciplines are a potential recipe. They are necessary, but definitely not a sufficient condition for development. Governments need to adjust to new conditions. They need to ensure that a whole set of domestic conditions is put in place so that trade opening and new rules can indeed result in development. If you will allow me a simplistic metaphor, market access and new rules are seeds. They will only really give fruit if the land is prepared, if the right conditions are present to promote growth and to fructify. Without those conditions, trade opening and improved rules will not suffice to promote growth and development. And that is not a job which will be done by WTO alone. In some circumstances, premature opening can even be harmful to the domestic economy. What I'm trying to say is that trade opening can only be politically and economically sustainable if it is complemented by other policies which address at the same time capacity problems. The immediate test of our ability to respond to this challenge, the challenge of creating a coherent international policy for development in WTO, is implemented through an initiative called Help for Trade. That is an initiative I'm quite sure you are familiar with, since the idea was advanced by UK last year and given political support by the G8 And today in the WTO, it's a new program which was just introduced in Hong Kong. Because trade is a complex economic activity, there are many different kinds of aid for trade. Technical assistance, helping countries gain knowledge of trade opportunities and how to access them. There is also institutional capacity building, strengthening customs authorities, tax systems, product testing standards, physical infrastructure, building roads, ports, telecommunication networks, adjustment assistance, helping with any transition costs linked to tariff reductions, preferences erosions, and declining terms of trade. So the agenda is potentially very, very large, but the complexity of the details, I think, should not blind us from the big picture. Aid for Trade is all about empowering developing countries to benefit from trade. And above all, it's about making the promise of international cooperation and coherence real, not only at global level, but at national level. Coherence starts at national level, coherence between trade, finance, and development policies. What is needed, as Mr. Pascal Lamy has been saying, is a new consensus among international actors. He has called it the Geneva Consensus, a new basis for the developing, or not, a new basis for the opening up of trade, but that takes into account the creation of the necessary conditions to benefit from trade. We need to ensure that market opening translates itself into real gains and benefits to all WTO members, poor, rich, small, big. And we can only do that by helping to put in place the necessary conditions for those gains and benefits to take place. We cannot ignore them. The Geneva Consensus combines the objectives of market opening with the establishment of conditions for benefiting from free trade, freer trade. Whether one is rich or poor, weak or strong. To me, therefore, the main question about this round of trade negotiations is not the kind of she's a big question you've put to us. Hamlet's dilemma of to be or not to be a development round. The main question is actually whether the results of this round will help poor countries increase their level of development or not. What I can tell you is that in terms of result, this round has a concrete potential to achieve much for developing countries. Potential. The old ways the big powers monopolized the driving seat are definitely over in WTO. Developing countries have gained both capacity and strength. Let's just look at the G20. The G20 group of countries led by Brazil, China, and India. They've completely changed the architecture of these negotiations. The G90 countries though constituted of the poorest countries, have a high political power in framing the negotiations. This round must necessarily meet the legitimate expectations of developing countries if it is to end successfully. We need this round to end and to be completed. We need it to end successfully, but I think one should realize today that that will not be possible if the developing countries' offensive interests in the round are ignored. It has been possible with the GATT. It has been possible with previous round. I think one should realize that it will not be possible with this current round. So will this round live up to its name? Will there be a discussion on whether or not the objective of promoting development has been achieved? In fact, we will only know the answer to these questions when the round is concluded, or even later, when the results are being implemented. So I will stand ready to pursue this reflection with you by then. But what I can do today is to raise another question to you. If the DDA fails as a development round, what is the alternative? Bilateral agreements in which whole poor and weak countries are being marginalized? Now, I think this round is more than a negotiation. It's really a test. It is a test of the global community's willingness to turning the talk of international cooperation and police coherence into meaningful results. A test of whether we can truly construct a global trading system where all countries can benefit. So this is a test for WTO. A more fragmented world is not an alternative. The world with greater marginalization, inequality, uncertainty, that's not an alternative. So at a time when shared prosperity and peace depend more than ever on multilateralism, the cost of failure extends far beyond the trade system. The DDA is too important, in our view, to fail. Millions are depending on it. So I will leave that question to your thought, and thank you very much for your kind attention.
Well, thank you very much. I think many people would agree that the WTO, which is a tiny little organization with a staff of only about 550 people, has nevertheless become the world's most important multilateral economic organization, much more important than the World Bank or the IMF, because its activities affect the welfare of many more people in a much deeper kind of way. The Deputy Director General has indicated that she is happy to take more questions about not only the main thrust of her talk today, but on what is likely to be happening in the Doha round negotiations before the end of this year. I should just say that before we came here, she indicated that she does think it is quite likely that the EU and the US will make major concessions on access to their agricultural markets. I take it by the end of this year. I don't want to hold you to that statement. That's my version of what you said. But in any case, let us have perhaps half an hour of questions. Yes.
Yeah, hello there. Thanks very much for that. Alex Widjuratna from ActionAid. I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit further if you think there will be another G6 meeting between now and the end of April, and also there's been talk of a ministerial-type level meeting before the summer. Could you elaborate on that, please?
The question is it likely that there will be a G6 meeting and another ministerial before April, the end of April, and another ministerial meeting by the summer? But can you just say what is the significance of the question? So what if there's a meeting or not? What's the significance of it?
Well, I think the significance is there was a G6 meeting in London last month, and actually there were no African or G90 countries there represented. So there's obviously issues of the sort of democratic workings of the WTO, and also Celso Amorim, the Brazilian trade minister, was talking about there needed to be a political injection or settlement now to move the stalled negotiations. So I think that's the context of the question, really.
So the question then is, will there be this political injection from the most powerful states to give momentum, further momentum to the Doha round in the next few months?
Why don't you answer that one?
Thank you very much. There's been this meeting of G6 ministers. It is most likely that another meeting will take place before the end of April. As you will recall that end of April is one of the deadline ministers agreed upon last December in Hong Kong. And this deadline concerned two main issues, that is agriculture and non-agriculture market access. Now, I will say some talk a little bit about the democratic inclusiveness and transparency process. Why are those six countries meeting and not involving other members of the WTO? Now, we always have to balance the transparency, the obligation of transparency, with efficiency. We know that in agriculture and non-agriculture market access, those who will have to make the political decisions, will have to make the move, are those big countries.
Therefore, which are the countries in the G6?
The G6 countries, in fact, are, I'm sorry, the US, the European communities, Japan, Brazil, India, and Australia. So those countries, three of them, those countries will have to move, and the move will have to be made on three points, which kind of constitute a triangle. They will have to move on agricultural market access. They will have to move on the domestic support subsidies in agriculture. And we know that on the domestic support subsidies in agriculture, that is the U.S. which has to make the move. When it comes to market access in agriculture, that is the EU which has to make the move. And when it came to non-agricultural market access, that is the so-called advanced developing countries which have to make the move, Brazil, India. You need those countries which at the end of the day will have to take these difficult political decisions to meet and discuss these political decisions, make the sacrifice, but we always make sure that the transparency is maintained immediately after the London meeting and after all restrained group meetings of the ministers. We organize what we call a trade negotiating a meeting in Geneva to inform all the rest of the membership. And therefore, the membership has to agree on what is being suggested or not. There is not a single G3 or 5 or 6 or 10. We have all kind of groupings currently in WTO. There is not a single grouping which can make a decision. The decision is to be taken by the whole membership at the end of the day.
Thank you. What about the ministerial meeting? Is there going to be one by the summer?
We will probably, by summer, let's also explain a little bit the background of this summer meeting, is that we do have a second deadline is to agree on modalities on other issues, but agriculture and non-agricultural market access by July. So that will take, that will be organized through a ministerial meeting, not necessary. It can be a general council meeting, and the general council meeting, it is the ambassadors who represent those countries which will have to take the decision. But definitely some ministerial, informal ministerial, used to take place shortly before that general council. Currently, you must know, tomorrow a G3 meeting is starting in Brazil.
Yes. Can you just introduce yourself?
Linda Korsha, LSE. Thank you for your talk. Could you say how you see the progress, the timetable, and the finalising of the services, this round of the services negotiations, please?
The question is, what is the timetable, what is the likely progress of the negotiations on services?
The progress of negotiation in services, as you know, the progress, in fact, what has happened in services in Hong Kong, is that ministers give priority to a plurilateral approach. The modern negotiation in services, it's a particular. It's through offer, a country make an offer, and another country answer to that offer. It's through offer and request. Now, through this process of offer and request, we haven't been able to achieve achieve much progress in the way to Hong Kong. The ministers there decide to give impetus to the approach of multilateral. How does it work? A group of countries make an offer to another group of countries. So this is what is taking place currently in Geneva. Request. They make requests. A group of countries really make a joint request to another group of countries. So the countries involved in the services negotiations, most of the time, are the countries which are willing to access a certain market or which are ready to offer their own market in exchange of access to another market. We must also recognize that in terms of results, the result in services negotiations have been mediocre. They really have been mediocre. There is not much additional market access offered in services. That means members, in the offers they are putting on the table, those offers are not offering additional market access. Most of the time, those offers are trying to secure what they've already done unilaterally. but they are not offering additional market access. Timetable of finalizing, we will have to have a text by July as well in services. A text, a negotiating text by July.
Anybody in the gallery? Yes. Can you introduce yourself? So the question then is, what...
Whether there has been addressed some issues of competition policy in the Doha round.
In services? Specific sector?
I think the point is that most of the negotiations involve states making agreements with other states. And the question is, what sort of progress has been made in developing rules governing the rights and obligations of multinational corporations, whether in services or in other areas? Is that right? Okay, so the additional point was that in the Uruguay round, some attention was given to this issue of rules on multinationals, but in the Doha round, that has been eclipsed, and there has been very little attention given to rights and obligations of multinationals. I take it.
Thank you very much for your question. The competition policy is one of the four so-called Singapore issues, the competition, investment, trade facilitation. Now, you will remember that in Cancun, that was one of the most controversial issues. Members couldn't agree on that, and members could not agree even on negotiating that. After Hong Kong, members decided to put aside the competition issue and investment issue. They decided to put them aside and keep only one of the four Singapore issues, that is trade facilitation. So currently, we are only negotiating trade facilitation. That is not to say that competition won't come back, but not in the Doha, during the Doha development round.
Yes.
Leo Herman from NSC. You've mentioned then, first of all, thank you very much for your talk, and you said that developing countries have participated very very strongly in this round. You mentioned the G90 and the other numerous Gs that we have.
G20, especially.
There's the G20, the G90 of poorer country. I want to ask something about more than just participation. Something about that is very lacking now in WTO, and that is the leadership. In terms of
leadership
in the WTO in order to move things forward, it seems quite obvious what are the gains for developing countries, or what exactly the objectives that you want from developed countries. What is the role of developing countries such as Brazil, India, and others? What kind of offer they can facilitate in order to get these concessions that, as Professor Wade said before, that he interprets that you think that they're willing to do? What is the bargain that you think that these countries can offer in order to move developed countries? That's one question. And the sub-question of it, is it really a good deal also for least developed countries? Is Brazil, India, I'm not mentioning China because China is very inactive, I think. Is it a really good deal for other developing countries? Thank you.
So the question is this, the big countries like Brazil and India are leading negotiations on agriculture, wanting better access for their agricultural exports to the markets of the US, the EU, and Japan. The first question is, what will they offer the EU and the US in return for better market access for agriculture? Sorry, the second question was... that's right. Would the interests of Brazil and India, the big countries, coincide with the interests of the small, poor, for example, sub-Saharan African countries? Would they also benefit from such a negotiation?
Thanks for your questions. The first question about what really the developing countries are ready to put on the table, they have indicated their willingness to put on the table market access in non-agricultural products, in industrial products. They've already indicated their willingness to do so, providing they get market access in agriculture products. That has been made very clear by the group of G20 countries. Now, we also have to bear in mind that developing countries don't constitute a kind of homogeneous group. They don't have the same offensive interest in all issues. The G20, for example, it's a coalition, an alliance only for agriculture. When we move to other sectors of negotiations, non-agricultural market access, Brazil doesn't have the same position than India. When we move to services, India is very much on the offensive side on services, and India wants absolutely in this ground to try and achieve additional market access in services, which is not necessarily the case of the other G20 countries. So the G20 is an alliance only for agriculture. Then what will the LDCs get? Is that group a good deal for the LDCs? I must say that the LDCs make their case as a specific group. They put their interests, offensive and defensives, on the table as the LDCs group and not as the G20 group. Of course, they joined the G20 group for some specific issues when it comes to flexibilities to be provided in specific rules, but the rest of the time, the LDCs put clearly their issues on the table as a separate group. And I must say that they have been successful in Hong Kong. They have been able to achieve concrete results in terms of duty-free, quota-free in Hong Kong.
I must say, I was not aware until you just said it just now that the G20 was functioning as an alliance only for agriculture, which suggests that it's a good deal less important than I thought it was. I thought it was a much more comprehensive alliance. Yes.
Hi, Danny Burris from the LSE. Just a question, I suppose it's a corollary of the one that was just asked about the role of developing countries in bringing forward a development agenda, and particularly about the future in this round for special and differential treatment. There's a whole lot of architectural, ambition out there from some commentators, for example, weaning away from the generalised system of preferences and other things. Where do you see that going in this round, and what are your, just a broad overview, a broad snapshot of perhaps reform of SDT?
So the question is, what are the prospects for giving, I take it, more content, more real content to the special and differential treatment clause, which has been reduced in the WTO mainly to simply giving longer adjustment periods for developing countries and LDCs to reach the same endpoint as the developed countries, longer adjustment periods. That's very different from special and differential treatment in the old GATT kind of way. And I take it your question is, what are the prospects for giving more substance, stronger teeth to the notion of special and differential treatment to developing countries because they are developing countries? Therefore, they should not be treated equally with developed countries.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's look at what has been achieved already in Hong Kong. The LDCs got a duty and quota-free access, and that is a special and differential treatment. Duty and quota-free access for 97% of their exports. Not only in developed countries, but also in developing countries. The developing countries here have been provided the flexibility to come in providing duty-free and quota-free to the LDCs after a longer period, transition period, and when they feel that they are ready to do so. So something has been achieved there already. There are prospects. There have not been a lot of progress in special and differential treatment, but let's also look at why. One of the difficulty of special and differential treatment is that you define as developing countries, Brazil, a country like Brazil, a country like Korea, and a country like Kenya. So one of the difficulties in the special and differential treatment is to put in place a measure which will respond to specific problems and situations faced by those countries. At the same time, you cannot apply the same flexibility for a country like Korea. So there is a need here to further define the developing countries. And of course, this is a point of serious controversy among the developing countries themselves.
Yes.
Yes.
Hello, David Baran from the International Insulin Foundation, a small charity that does health services research and looks at access to medicines issues.
From the which foundation?
International Insulin Foundation.
Insulin.
Thank you very much for your extremely interesting talk. I was just wondering, with regards to the whole discussion of Doha and development and what Professor Wade said about the WTO becoming an extremely important actor in development, even more so important than the World Bank or the IMF, what do you see as the future role that the WTO will play in the whole issue of access to medicines? Thank you.
So the question is, what is the current and future role of the WTO in improving access to medicines on the part of people in developing countries, low-income people, low-income countries?
Thank you very much for your question. This, in fact, is has been one of the achievements shortly before Hong Kong to agree to amend the agreement on intellectual property for medicines, which in such a manner that we enable developing countries which do not have the capacity to get access to those medicines to not be bound by this agreement of intellectual property. So they have been allowed to really, through the amendment of this agreement of TRIPS that was just the first week of December. It was really a couple of days before Hong Kong. This was one of the main achievements of the negotiation in Geneva. So that has been done. But I will also want to add here that it is one thing to have the proper rule, to have the flexibility which enable the countries to really access those medicines. It is another question to have the proper technology to develop those industries.
Can you just elaborate on that? It's one thing to have rules of access, but it's another thing to have the technology.
To have the necessary technology. The flexibility has been provided. Let me take a case. Case of a country like Uganda, for example, where HIV/AIDS has been a problem. They achieved positive results in really tackling this issue. So today, through this agreement, they are being provided the opportunity to manufacture or to order the medicine they require from any source, the best source possible. The best for the public health system will be to be enabled to manufacture them at regional level and to really be able to plan in long term how they will be to kind of secure the supply. But they don't have the necessary technology to do so. So the rule is there, provide flexibility to do so, but you need the technology.
But can Uganda import from India, for example?
Oh, Uganda, they are doing so already. They are doing so. But after importing the generics, one might look at a further stage, being able to manufacture those treatments, and the necessary conditions are not met for Uganda to be able to do so today.
I think we have time for just one more question. Did you want to follow up on that?
Sorry, with regards to aid for trade, you said that the WTO would help provide support, capacity building, infrastructure. Do you foresee something like that being done for the access to medicines issue?
The question is whether the WTO will provide countries with help for access to medicine similar to that which the WTO is providing under the aid for trade agreement.
A straightforward response, I don't see that happening. I don't see that happening for a simple reason. The WTO is not going to become a financial or a development agency. It is not going to be. Our role and our core role will remain to set trade rules and to negotiate trade agreements. Having said that, we recognize that is very much needed and it's a priority, but that's not our comparative advantage. And that's why we need international coherence. We need international coherence. We need to work with other agencies which have the comparative advantage of doing so. But this is not something we'll be doing. Now, just a word on aid for trade. On aid for trade as well, aid for trade today, we've achieved, we've been able to really politically highlight the need of aid for trade. Today, the rationale is very clear. Nobody is really challenging why aid for trade. What we are working at today, it's how we will do that, and how we will do aid for trade as well. That's why we're working closely with the World Bank, with the IMF, with regional development banks as well, and other development agencies. Those agencies and those partners will be the one to deliver on aid for trade, to implement aid for trade. we're playing here a role of catalyst in terms of aid for trade, but it is already a revolution to bring a subject such as aid for trade in the WTO agenda. It is a recognition that trade opening doesn't make whole WTO members reap benefits automatically.
Good. Well, Valentin Rugwabiza, thank you very much for your talk and for the answers and the questions. Thank you very much. Thank you.